Initiating startup sequence.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Martian ambassador is going to say a few words.
Gotcha! Citizens of the universe!
Welcome to Other Planes, the Afrofuturist and Speculative Cultures podcast.
Universal people looking for the perfect meaning for the world nations.
Very pleased to have none other than Minister Faust, novelist, teacher, writer, journalist, playwright, and poet. Minister Faust is known for his Afrofuturist, surrealist, and magical realist novels, The Coyote Kings, From the Notebooks of Dr. Brain, aka Shrinking the Heroes, The Alchemists of Kush, and the War and Mirror series. He's also an author of video games, including Mass Effect 2 DLC, Gift of the Yeti, and Darkspore. He writes for stage and sketch comedy, print journalism, and is a broadcaster of Afrocentric Radio. In this extended conversation with Minister Faust, we discuss, among other things, the upcoming sequel to his novel, The Coyote Kings of the Space Age Bachelor Pad, which will be serialized and available through his Patreon at ministerfaust.com, the ins and outs of independent publishing, how to balance making money in the art world with focusing upon the work and how to promote it, what Edmonton is really like, the state of canlit, and a little bit of dabbling into comedy, philosophy, and symbolism. Without further ado, here is Minister Faust. All right, so I am here with Minister Faust from Edmonton, the acclaimed black science fiction author, if I may say so, if that is the correct term. Fill me in here. How can I describe you, Minister Faust?
Sure. Well, author is entirely appropriate, and if you want an ethnic designator, you could say Kenyan-Canadian.
Kenyan-Canadian. And more than just an author as well, you are a broadcaster. You've been involved with campus and community radio for many years. I first heard about you when I was at CITR Radio 101.9 FM back in the 90s. How long have you been involved with community broadcasting, radio, and science fiction and comics?
Wow. Well, I mean, to take the first one, I got involved with community radio back in 1989. So that's going back now just shy of 30 years. And I got into comics when I was 5, even before I could read. So I guess that takes me back about 44 years. So I've always, and that, you know, that associated with that, I probably was watching Star Trek before that, the original series. So I guess I've always known and been part of science fiction in one way or another for, you know, most of my aware life.
That's incredible. I have read several of your books now. I think I might have missed one or two. I'm starting to realize.
Okay.
But I have on my shelf right behind me here, Shrinking the Heroes, which I believe was retitled.
That's right. Yeah, the original title for which it won the Kindred Award was From the Notebooks of Dr. Brain. That was never that was the editor's choice for that title. And but in fairness, I didn't come up with the title Shrinking the Heroes until later. I after I got it, I thought, why didn't I come up with that first? So because it's, for people who don't know the book, it's a play on words since the book involves psychology.
It's an amazing book, actually. It's kind of like if you took the Avengers and put them into psychotherapy and then had them all have to deal with a very uncomfortable issue of race.
Yeah,
for them.
I
mean,
that's a good,
it like blew my mind. It was actually the first book that I read from you, and since then I've picked up the Mirror series. I mean, I have a way to describe it, but describe for our audience briefly what's happening with the Mirror series.
Sure, War and Mirror. So it is a trilogy. The final volume will be out either late this year or early next year, and The way I describe it as, it's Star Wars meets the Grapes of Wrath.
That's excellent. Yeah, it's a bit of space opera. I always felt that it kind of opened up a bit like Afro Samurai meets Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, there's absolutely Hitchhiker's. The Hitchhiker's part was very self-conscious. There is a device, it performs the similar role to the Babelfish. So in this case, it's called the Akmek, which, here's a little scoop. That's that name from an alien language called Sauladu is simply, it's a portmanteau of language acquisition mechanism. So, but yeah, so, and the idea of, you know, it's been a long time, decades since I've read Hitchhiker's Guide, but what is the name of the alien who's the buddy of the main character?
Ford Prefect.
Oh, So Ford, so I have a character similar to that who, except that, you know, he has a tougher time with English. So, that's been fun to work on that project, and I'm glad that it'll be soon wrapped up.
Very stoked that the third issue in the trilogy is finally coming out. I've been waiting for that. You know what? I'm sitting here without the titles in front of me, which is a silly mistake.
Problem. Well, there's the Coyote
there's
Kings.
There's Coyote Kings.
And the Alchemist of Kush.
The Alchemist of Kush is in my perspective, just one of the most brilliant science fiction books I've read in a long time. I mean, I wouldn't call it science fiction. How do we describe this book?
Well, it's fantasy, and that one also could call magical realism. Although I tend to think magical realism is what people who think they're too good for fantasy call fantasy.
Yes, there. Yeah, absolutely. But it parallels a kind of mythological take on Kemet, ancient Egypt, and mm-hmm. the founding myths of Kemet, and then runs a parallel narrative with social activists in Edmonton, in the Somali community, if memory serves me correct.
That's right. Somali Canadians and to an extent Sudanese, South Sudanese
right.
Canadians.
That book, I can't wait to teach it. I'm waiting for the right opportunity. But yeah. All right, describe to us Coyote Kings, because what we're here to talk about is you're working on the sequel to Coyote Kings.
Right. Okay. So the original Coyote Kings, the story is a couple of young men in Edmonton, 1995. And when I first generated the story, it was 1995. And the kind of subgenre of science fiction in which fans, you know, people who are science fiction fans are in the book, that was not very widely developed at that time. The movie Free Enterprise had already come out, so that wasn't a science fiction story, but you got to see fans represented realistically, unlike, I would say, the Big Bang Theory, which is much more of a non-fans caricature of what fans look like. Mm. And so these are two young, you know, they're Generation X African-Canadians, you know, very smart guys who are stuck in McJobs. And they meet a mysterious, remarkable, fascinating Ethiopian woman who introduces them to an extremely fascinating secret, and that is that magic is real. But of course, if magic were real, that would place you in immediate danger. And so the book is about these two young men who are best friends having to explore an ancient mystery while they lock horns with a very dangerous drug gang in Edmonton called the Fanboys, who peddle a mind-altering substance called cream, and some old rivals from high school and university who used formerly good friends and now bitter enemies, the Wolves, who are their family name is the Meanies. So, and they, all of them are after ultimately the same thing, and it all puts them and the human race in peril. Yeah. So that's the Coyote Kings. And obviously, I think it's fair to say that the protagonists survive, which is why there is a sequel. And people had been asking me for a very long time. In fact, even before the book was published, I had some interest from my agent at the time and my the publisher in a sequel. And at that time, I was really against sequels in books. And then, you know, I realized, why am I being so snobbish about this? I adore serialized television. So why should I be against serialized books? And then once I came to that conclusion, I thought, well, yeah, now this opens up so many possibilities. And I love the 1990s. So the book starts 2 years after the end of Coyote Kings. It takes place in 1997. Huh. And our main characters are called. They get a call. They get a call from some women they knew from university. And it turns out that they used to take classes from a very influential ecology professor. It was a deep ecology professor. And so this man brought in all kinds of fascinating stuff about Gaia and fungal intelligence and, the saving the human race from ecological destruction. And anyway, this professor has moved up north in Alberta to the tar sands and has founded a type of community there where he's raised the ire of local biker gangs, the RCMP, oil companies, and he's been murdered.
Oh, no.
So the Coyote Kings get called up to help solve who has killed their favorite professor.
This is terrible. I'm sorry to hear the professor of deep ecology has been murdered. I'm teaching deep ecology starting next week. This doesn't bode well for me. So this is a murder case with a bit of a twist to it, I am sure.
Yes, there'll be a bunch of twists, and I hope there'll be the kind of mind-blowing twist that as people go through the book, they will sometimes want to throw the book across the room and say, what? And that, because, you know, that doesn't have to be a bad thing. Sometimes you should be astonished and horrified. And so I'm very excited. I've been, I had ideas about a sequel. Nothing really gelled. And I learned a long time ago that when you're trying to form a story, a long form story, if it doesn't seem to be working, it's because you're not passionate about the contents. And so the best thing to do is dust off your old notebooks or click open your old files for stories that you abandoned. And usually what is there is that it's half of a good idea or it's a quarter of a good idea. So you Frankenstein them, or in a more gentle, loving way, you set them up on a date and you see if they will make beautiful magic together. So that's what I did. I took some old stories that I didn't think I was going to be able to work on, and I realized, like, oh no, this is the perfect story for the Coyote Kings, and I already had these characters that I cared about, and I thought, this is it.
I mean, that's an excellent way to go about the creative process. I mean, like, not reusing material, but just like realizing that you've already created a lot of material sometimes, and you just need to like frame it. Yeah. You know, I was thinking about your approach here with like serialization. I mean, that's how Charles Dickens wrote all of his novels,
yeah,
right? I mean,
absolutely.
They were originally published in periodicals in like a magazine format, basically. Most people don't realize this today. And then, you know, later they were put together into novels, which is why they're so bloody long.
Yeah, sure. They were long, and it made sense for an economic reason. It was like they were like TV shows. Yeah. You wanted to string the audience along and sell more copies of newspapers. It makes total sense. And people love it. And also we like a little bit of the building of anticipation. Mm-hmm. You know, when there's a big difference between being able to, I know that I can't remember the term for it, but when you engorge yourself on all 8 episodes on Netflix at once, what's that called? When
people binge watching.
The thing about binging is that it's very easy to puke afterwards. And so when you watch a whole bunch of a series immediately, I think that my impression is that we simply don't retain our love for it the way we used to when a show was with us over the course of 5 or 7 more years, because we've had all those life changes ourselves. Whereas if you go through, like, say, 5 seasons of a show over the course of a week, sure, you've fallen passionately in love for a week, but then it's gone. And so I think that those shows kind of drop out of our conversations very quickly. And it doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with the show. It's the format. I remember once somebody, you know, the first book came out in 2004, and somebody asked, well, why does this take place in 1995? And some people, you know, when there's been talk over the years about turning it into a TV series or a movie, the questions were, well, could we update it? And I think, well, what's the point of updating it? It takes place in a specific time, and then if you update that, well, then you're just continually playing catch-up, because mm-hmm. when people watch the show later, they're going to say, like, why is this in 2018? It's already 2019. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. things happen in real time. Just let them.
Yeah, hopefully with the popularity of shows like Stranger Things that are set back in the 80s, it allows us to start framing the 90s in such a way that it has a distinct look and like a distinct period. I know a lot of my students out there, my millennial and now younger than millennial students, look, you know, they fetishize the 90s to like a large degree, you know, in ways that horrify me, but are completely understandable because when I was growing up in the 90s, we fetishized the 60s. So, you know, it's
well, yeah. So I'm curious, so, like, what are the things that stand out for them other than cassettes, which is one that drives me bananas. As a longtime DJ, I can say there's no good reason to like cassettes, but
there's one good reason to like cassettes. DJ mixes still sound better on cassette because you can overdrive the mix on analog tape. Records sound better recorded on a cassette. That's all I'm saying.
All right, okay, well, it is your show, so I'm just going to let that one go. But anything else from the 90s that they kind of Google and goggle
Here's
over?
Here's the weird thing. Mom jeans.
Yeah, the hips to be square kind of nonsense.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Yeah, that one I have to say, the people who really went gaga for irony have killed sweaters. I cannot buy a sweater was a sweater, and now they're called pullovers.
This is interesting. Somehow this is going to tie into Coyote Kinks. Actually, tell me about the way in which you went about world building the 90s for you, because this is also a very specific region. This is Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, which is the provincial capital of the province of Alberta. For those who aren't from Canada, this is the oil region of Canada. Up in the north, it's a massive, massive province. You have, as you were saying, the tar sands, where oil is taken out of the ground, so much devastating environmental impact, and continuous conflict with indigenous title and indigenous peoples. And Edmonton and Calgary are very interesting and very different cities. Calgary is quite, as we say, multicultural, but is also the seat of power for the oil interests and the sort of a staging of conflict between these two regions, classes, also racial and gender divides. And then Edmonton is the seat of political power, and often kind of gets looked over when you're looking at Alberta. But I mean, I've DJed in Edmonton in the 90s. You were saying 97. I think 97 was the last time I DJed in Edmonton, in the basement of a skyscraper, at a rave called Build, which was not very well attended because it was like a diehard, like Detroit techno style event.
Right.
Playing Afrofuturist Detroit techno back in the day in Edmonton.
Right.
But yeah, tell me about Edmonton in the 90s and what that city
was
like.
Well, you know, for me, it was easy to world build the 90s because the original screenplay, I mean, I wrote it as a screenplay in 1995. And so then when I turned it into a novel in 2001 and it was published in 2004, you know, in 2001, the memories of 1995 were still very fresh. The Edmonton region now, as we called it back then, we called it E-Town. And the one who gave us that name was the late, great DJ, T-E-D-D-Y, Teddy Pemberton. And so he called it E-Town. This is long before people locally started to call it YEG as a result of Twitter. But, you know, now we're around a million people. Back then it was probably about 750,000, something like that. And the city's, it was always been extraordinarily multicultural, multi-religious, a dynamic, absolutely dynamic art sector. It has the second largest fringe festival, which is a small theater in the world. The only one bigger is the original one in England. It's got, in English-speaking Canada, the best theater scene, comedy improv scene, for a while, the best sketch comedy scene. And, you know, it's an amazing place. Also, it's the natural beauty is stunning.
It's a beautiful city. Yeah, this, like, river delta runs through the city with all these green pathways and there's bridges over it.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Yeah. It's gorgeous. And so it's an amazing place. It's a great place to be a writer or a visual artist. It's a great music scene. It's interesting you bring up Calgary because the relationship between Calgary and Edmonton is like that between, as I understand it, between Houston and Austin. So we're both, you know, both petro states, But in the case of Edmonton and Austin, really vibrant culture and far more in the way of progressive politics. So, you know, people who are listening can't see that I'm wearing a red sweater, but that's, you know, that I guess that tells you a lot. That's what you need to know. And not for the Canadians, the Liberal Party red, but red in the old red flag sense. So, yeah, so I mean, Edmonton is—it's an amazing place, and I grew up here. My family goes back to 1939 here, and I just loved the idea back then of bringing in the kind of science fiction and fantasy fans that I knew, and I had always known that were not the stereotype of the guy who has tape wound around his glasses and gets beaten up. I mean, that's sort of like really dumb American movie and TV cliches. That wasn't my experience of being a fan ever. There's only, in really, my entire life, there was only a couple of people, and it might literally be two, whoever tried to make some stupid joke because I was a fan. And so I just want to write about people like that and then, you know, bring in this actual fantasy adventure that also at times delves into horror. And then, another element of it was that I'm a Kenyan Canadian. This is an amazing city full of lots of Somali Canadians, South Sudanese, Nigerians, Ghanaians, South Africans, and more. And that was in terms of, you know, this might not make as much sense to your American listeners, but to what we call CanLit, Canadian literature.
yes, CanLit.
CanLit is, up until recently, it was overwhelmingly Euro-Canadian, but it was even not just Euro-Canadian because, you know, where I live in Alberta, it's a very Ukrainian place. It's a very German place. But none of the stories I ever took in school featured Ukrainian or German Canadians. I mean, how is that? That's mm-hmm. nuts, you know? So what we ended up getting was this weird Eastern Canadian, by which I mean Ontarian perspective on what the prairies was supposed to be. There was this weird movement in the development of Canadian literature where people were trying to, they were forcing a concept of CanLit on the country, and they concluded that something about the eternal loneliness of the prairies, that was somehow quintessentially Canadian. And, you know, there should be a wolf in there somewhere and a lonely blonde boy, you know, wandering through the wheat fields. It's like, that has nothing to do with my life or the life of any kid that I ever grew up with in the city. And that's one reason we had no interest in CanLit, because we were given this utterly boring, depressing fiction. Like, and when I say fiction, what I mean is an artifice that didn't represent our lives. So I was one of the people who was writing stories set in the city, in a multicultural contemporary metropolis that brought in a range of African Canadian cultures, hip hop music, fan culture. So I'm sorry, that's a very lengthy answer, but that is, the world building was, all I had to do was represent the real world that was in front of me. And that's why these people who are so against diversity are really just wanting to lie about what the world looks like. They actually want to create a fictional version that wipes out everybody who isn't like them, including, of course, wiping out all queer people, because they also don't get to appear in these stories.
That's actually really interesting you bring this up, because when I was an undergraduate in the 90s, that was a time, I mean, I'm sure this started much earlier in the 80s, but the question of challenging the Canadian canon and CanLit was at the forefront of English studies at UBC at the time. So there were a number of books coming out that were doing precisely this. Nala Hopkinson's first book came out.
Brown Girl in the Ring.
Brown Girl in the Ring, like 97, 98. Yeah. I mean, there were a number of texts, and this was a question, but I mean, I remember having to go through the quote-unquote Canadian canon of the time. A lot of Susanna Moody, a lot of, actually, we didn't even read that much Farley Mowat, come to think of it. But yeah, it was mainly Eastern Canadian focused and all white settler narratives.
Yeah.
The rest of Canada was mostly forgotten. Indigenous literature was not even touched upon. Over the past 25 years, it's been that long now. This has changed. And so have the narratives in Canada around us, quote unquote, us as a nation. Mm. I mean, we've gone through truth and reconciliation process, and there's been much more open discussion about the tensions and class issues and endemic poverty amongst racialized communities. mainly pertaining to places like Toronto. But I mean, this is an ongoing discussion, which is much more present in the national consciousness than it was 20 years ago.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's been great to see those changes. And a lot of people have been responsible, including academics such as yourself, journalists, now, of course, through the internet, bloggers and podcasters and obviously the writers producing the work. And an important feature that probably hasn't, at least to my knowledge, you could correct me on this, that probably hasn't had as much an impact inside the Academy is independently published fiction. So now it's possible for people who, you know, publishers wouldn't gamble on their work. And now they can reach people directly. So I think that as that bias against independent publishing declines, we are going to see more and more stories of a huge range. And by the way, that would also include an awful lot of white male voices that we never got because they were about, for instance, being a Ukrainian in Alberta, or they were about being a recent Serbian immigrant. So there's all these, when people want to attack, you know, and from a white supremacist perspective, attack diversity, they forget, like, no, most of those white cultural experiences, those were wiped out. And if you were a white man who was blue collar, those were also wiped out. So, you know, attack diversity at your own peril.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's actually fantastic that you bring up independent publishing, because this probably is a great moment to ask how we can follow Coyote Kings and get on board with the serial delivery of chapters. I know I'm excited to begin reading it, and I believe you're setting up a subscription service for this.
It's going to be I've already been supporting my podcast MF Galaxy using Patreon. And so for people who are not familiar with Patreon, it's like Kickstarter, except that you pay a small amount monthly or per unit that's put out. And so what I'll be doing is the book will probably clock in at about 20 chapters. And so the entry level to get access to each chapter, which should come out about once a week, is a buck, because people, I think, are okay with spending $20 on a book of a reasonable enough length. And then if you spend a little bit more, then you get access to, I'll do some videos that, you know, me talking about the process. And for people who are writers or they'd like to be writers, that's often quite helpful. And also, I do a lot of art myself, I do art, but also I do art as part of my work of generating stories. So people will get, there'll be production art. You know, one of the characters named Yi Hat, and he developed a type of high-tech body armor. So, you know, I'm going to be able to show people what that actually looks like.
Very cool.
Yeah, and I'll have photography of Edmonton, and the part of the book takes place in Fort McMurray, so there'll be stuff from there. I'm almost certainly going to do some mock movie posters, because the tagline for the book is, in the tar sands, the deadliest toxin is man. And that is that's a reference to the movie poster for The Thing, because there are some aspects from John Carpenter's The Thing that go here. Otherwise, I wouldn't use the gendered expression.
Oh, very cool.
The gendered expression man, because I'm riffing specifically on that. And then for people who are going to pay, you know, even a little bit more if they want to, there'll be stuff like Ask the Author Anything, and I'll do those sessions from time to time. And also, as I get feedback from people, the book is going to change.
When I looked at the chat window with Minister Faust, I had originally contacted you back in 2010.
Right.
When I was writing my dissertation. And we had set up a time. We were going to do an interview then, and then it fell through. And 8 years later,
it's a discussion. Well, the time is obviously right now, and that's the key. The time is right now.
The time is right now, indeed. And I'm very much looking forward to this serial publication of the Patreon. What is the link, sir?
Go to my website, ministerfaust.com. The link's not up yet. It's going to be on Patreon.
Yeah, but ministerfaust.com will get you there.
Exactly.
And your podcast is MF Galaxy, which is all over the podcast universe. Just search for it.
That's right. Yep.
And for those who haven't subscribed yet to Minister Faust's podcast, it is incredible. He's talked to more people anywhere about everything from filmmakers to authors to artists. Afrofuturists, but just everything and anything in the independent, underground, incredibly diverse global art scene at this point. I mean, I've been trying to catch up on your podcasts. And there's often a lot of amazing practical information about art making, art creating for indie audiences especially. So tune into MF Galaxy if you have not already.
Thanks for the kind words about that and also for noting that, yeah, it's definitely about a podcast created with the intent of helping people advance as artists. And that means developing their craft and learning how to make money. Artists are I think some people think like, oh, no, I don't want to sully myself and ruin my soul. So look, if you don't make money, then by definition, you are not a professional. A professional means you make money for the work. Mm-hmm. So if you don't want to do it just for the love, which is what the word amateur means, and you should love it, but if you need to get paid, then you need to talk with other artists and figure out how they're doing it.
It's absolutely important to find ways to make a living in a society which continuously exploits the narratives of marginalized peoples as well. I was just thinking about something else too. I was reading an interview with Alejandro Jodorowsky, filmmaker, performance artist, and I don't know what he's doing these days. It's like magic psychotherapy. And he was talking about, he always loved promoting his films, and he said he put as much time into promotion as he did into filming and post-production. And that struck me because what I've been doing arts of various kinds for many years. I'm a turntablist, I'm a media artist, I do this podcast, but I've never put much time into promotion. I have that almost a quintessential Canadian reserve of not promoting.
Yeah.
And so what you're doing in the sense of waking up artists to promoting their own work and speaking about it is very important. And it's especially important if you come from what I think is almost an ideological premise of, oh, keep it underground, don't promote it.
Yeah.
You know what? That might have worked in the 80s and 90s as kind of an elusive allure. And today I also agree, yes, there's no point in like signal boosting to the point where you're just like constantly spamming with like, you know, automated Twitter accounts.
Yes.
But being real about your promotion and talking with real people about it is an absolute must, because it engenders support and community and actually creates the kind of community of art and artists and social change that we want to see in the world, you know.
Life is a test and a quest to universe. And through my research, I felt the joy and I heard. The first shall be last and the last shall be first. The basic instructions before leaving Earth.
So yeah, I do like that older commitment to making something lasting. You know, the advice from, and I can't remember if it's the instructions of Ptah Hotep, but it goes back, you know, like 4,000 some years, is to be a scribe. And there's all kinds of wonderful advice in there. You just Google the words "be a scribe" and Egyptian wisdom literature, you'll find it. And a lot of it's pretty snobby. It's basically like, hey, be a writer because you don't want to be carrying all those bricks and boards, and be a writer because that's better than being a blank, blank, blank. But a lot of it is really about saying that the life of writing is going to offer you value that you can't get any other way. Mm-hmm. You know, and I work in other fields that I have really loved, but writing, especially when you get to engage with other people, and I would include like what you and I are doing right now, which is conversing, and of course I'm also an interviewer, getting to hear other people, not writing just your own opinion pieces, which can be very, very narcissistic, but talking with other people, getting their perspectives and learning from them, being open. When I interview people, I have to shut up. That's my job, is to ask a question and then let them do the talking. And I get more out of that because I'm not trying to think of what's my next thing to say.
Although as an interviewer right now, I have to think of the next thing to say. That's I really like the idea of be a scribe. I mean, there's a we'll kind of end with that, I think. But I mean, there's a deeper mystical reading there too, of course, the Egyptian culture of writing and hieroglyphs. The idea of inscription it pertains to Thoth, to Hudi,
yes,
the god of writing and death, who I can't show your listeners, but is tattooed on my arm. Thoth as the god of writing and death. This is not death in the negative sense. This is death in the sense of transformation and transcendence to the next level.
Resurrection.
And resurrection, rebirth. And writing is one of the pathways, and I think in Egyptian culture it's probably one of the most profound pathways of doing so. And not just writing in the sense of writing things down, but developing forms of communication and symbolic ritual that would carry forth meaning beyond the death of your body on this plane. If you know the history of Western philosophy, you know that Socrates infamously argued against writing. He argues against the Egyptian position, denigrates writing as a secondary art to the immanence of speech. And that is, in a sense, also an interestingly racialized narrative. So if you study philosophy and the history of Western philosophy, the rebirth of writing, the recognition that writing and the mark is not secondary, but is one of, I think, the primary forms of communication in like the broadest sense, but also of the means of transformation, self transformation through techne, through artistry. So that is me riffing off on something here, but be a scribe and what that means in your life. You don't have to literally become a writer. What that means is write your own life story, right? Become a writer of your own narratives. Take control of your own myths. Right.
Yeah. Well said. I absolutely agree. It's interesting, you know, what you were saying a moment ago about Socrates. I hadn't been aware that he had attacked writing as an Egyptian position, because the early Greek philosophers, of course, were influenced by the most powerful and long-lasting civilization of the region, which was, of course, an African civilization of Egypt, Kemet. And so many people have said that there was a whole body of Egyptian wisdom that was passed on exclusively orally, and that has been lost, and that much of the Egyptian literary tradition of religious writings was actually symbolic. It was philosophical. It was metaphysical, in the Greek sense of the word metaphysics, that it was an exploration of the nature of reality and thought. And so, I'd be interested to hear more about this potential Socratic rejection of Egypt, if that's in fact the case, because the Egyptian position was that both of these things matter, that the spoken word, and in fact in many Egyptian origin stories of the universe, it's the god Atum who speaks the words of creation that bring reality, which later becomes a feature of Hellenized Christianity, as in the beginning was the word and the word was God.
Logos.
Exactly. So the creative utterance is divinity itself.
Vision.
All right, Minister Faust, thank you so much for such a wide-ranging and amazing conversation here on Other Planes. And I look forward to having you back, actually.
Hey, I'd love
catching up with you once again.
Love to come on anytime. It's really great to talk with you, and great questions and lovely range of conversational topics.
Excellent. Thank you for tuning in to Other Planes, and a big thanks to our host, creativedisturbance.org, through MIT's Leonardo Arts Organization, for keeping us going. Tune in next time for a series of interviews from the Black Speculative Arts Movement Toronto First Edition, including audio from the opening ceremony, panels with Stacey Robinson, and more. Peace.